Yes, and that was Everything Crash by the Ethiopians. And on that subject, we are joined in the studio by Richard Heinberg, who has come here to talk to us and share some ideas about The End of Growth, which is a book that really explores how in classic, when modern economists take some classic economic models where you must have capital, you must have labor, you must have land in order to have economic growth and have an economy work, somehow the part about the land, which means resources, which means the earth itself, has been taken out of the equation, and hey, we're running out of the resources. So he's here to talk to us about that, and that's hence the title, The End of Growth. We not only have climate change and rising sea levels, but we also have something of major, major importance and major significance coming along pretty rapidly, which is the constant depletion of resources. And so Richard Heinberg, who is an author and an instructor, an educator, who has been on the faculty with New College in Santa Rosa, and also is a senior fellow with the Post Carbon Institute, which is based in Sebastopol, California, and is the author of 10 books, is it? 10 books?
Yeah.
And let's make sure we got you on this. Hang on just a second.
A New College, unfortunately, is defunct as of a couple of years ago, but Post Carbon Institute is very much alive and now headquartered in downtown Santa Rosa.
And now I have a couple of questions for you. I have a book in front of me, which
yes.
is Compliments of You. Thank you very much.
Sure.
And it's titled The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. Now, wasn't one of your books called The End of Oil? What was it?
Well, actually, it's called The Party's Over.
The Party's Over.
That came out in 2003 with a revised edition in 2005. There was also Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, The Oil Depletion Protocol, Blackout, which is about coal, climate, and the last energy crisis, and another book called Peak Everything in there.
Oh, yeah, Peak Everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's really something just for people to get their head around peak oil.
Right.
And actually get your head around peak anything, and then to be confronted with peak everything,
yeah.
It's kind of like, wait a minute, what now?
Yeah, right.
But maybe just for the basics here, you know, just for really basic on what is peak oil?
Sure.
And then get to, hey, why do you think that economic growth is ending? Because that seems to be the whole buzzword right now.
Oh, yeah.
We've got to have a return to economic growth or we're dead.
Right, okay. Well, peak oil is really a discussion about, it's more of an observation than anything else. Because any oil field reaches a maximum rate of production and then declines. And whole nations that produce oil see the same thing happen. The U.S. used to be the world's foremost oil-producing nation. In fact, we were the world's foremost oil-exporting nation. But our oil discoveries peaked back in the early 1930s, and U.S. oil production has been declining since about 1970. So more and more countries are seeing the same thing happen. Countries that used to be big exporters are now turning into importers, countries like Great Britain and Indonesia. But the discussion really is about what happens when total world oil production reaches its maximum and begins to decline. That's likely to be a big problem because oil is our main energy source, and energy is what enables everything to happen. Our economy does not just include energy as one element. Really, our economy is energy. If you take away oil, if you take away electricity, the economy grinds to a halt almost instantly. So we've built the kind of fast-paced global economy we have today because we had superabundant, cheap, concentrated energy in the form of fossil fuels. So when oil gets more scarce and expensive, as is actually happening right now,
yeah.
That puts a drag on the entire economy. And that's one of the reasons that I'm seeing world economic growth grinding to a halt right now.
You know, I've even tried to get it. It looks as though there's constant discoveries, but they seem to, the discoveries seem to be deeper in the earth and harder to get to. I mean, man, when you're talking about squeezing oil out of sand in Canada, that's not a gusher.
Yeah.
That's not a gusher there, folks.
Yeah, what's happening is we're replacing reserves of high quality, easy to access, cheap oil with reserves of harder to access, more expensive oil that also carries greater environmental risks. We're doing that with the tar sands. We're doing it with shale oil in North Dakota. We're doing it with ultra-deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico. And as I say, the environmental risks are greater, as we saw last year in 2010 with the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe.
Mm, yeah.
We are operating at the very limit of our technical capacity. And going after these extreme forms of energy has a dollar cost as well as an environmental cost. So these days, the oil companies need oil prices up in the range of $85 to $90 a barrel just to justify going out and looking for more of this hard oil.
Right. And that means at the pump, and without subsidies, I mean, even even with subsidies, which are huge in the United States, that means $4 a gallon gasoline.
That's right. And that puts a drag on the rest of the economy because if 70% of our economy is consumer spending, then consumers have less money in their pockets after they're paying $100 to fill up their SUV, and they're having trouble paying for their credit card bills, their mortgages. And in fact, it's the price of oil that has helped create the current economic crisis. If you go back to 2008...
That's very interesting.
You know, with the housing bubble, as we were seeing housing prices going through the ceiling, that stopped and turned around in 2007, 2008 as oil prices went up. And the places where this started were the outlying suburbs where people were having to spend so much to fill up their cars and drive every day. Those are the places where people...
They were ready to dump those properties.
They started dumping their properties because they couldn't afford to live in those places anymore.
Yeah.
And that set off a chain reaction.
Because the minute the value of the property got below what it was mortgaged for...
Right.
Like if somebody were to... Yeah. If somebody were to keep getting mortgages and mortgages and mortgages on it so that they could keep getting more SUVs...
Right. And those...
And
those,
cash out the equity.
Those people, in many cases, or maybe even most cases, also had second mortgages and home equity lines of credit based on the inflated value of the home. So when those house values started to decline, suddenly all of the assets that the banks held... See, when you and I take out a loan at the bank, that's an obligation to repay. But for the bank, that same loan is an asset.
Right, that's right.
So those assets for the banks started to lose value, and they lost value to the tunes of hundreds of billions and even trillions of dollars. And that's really what set off the cascading economic crisis of 2008.
And you do an excellent job in The End of Growth. I'm speaking right now with Richard Heinberg, who is an educator and author, and definitely an activist. And in The End of Growth, you have, I would encourage anybody who is looking to go into a course on economics to read this book, because it's the best and most concise. The first 75 pages are, in fact, you don't even have to go through 75 pages. The first 50 pages are kind of the best and most concise wrap-up of really what economics is about. Concepts, you got all the concepts and how it's always been looked at. You got Adam Smith, you got all of the ways of looking at how nations prosper, how what is capital, you know, what and how does an economy thrive?
Yeah.
And what are the basics? So you get a complete rundown of the basics and why the U.S. economy did so great during the 1950s and the 1960s and then started kind of like hitting the skids in the 70s. And the piece that continually keeps being left out is other than maybe, you know, you had the Arab embargo is what's blamed on the 70s.
Right.
But you're saying, oh, no, no, no. the peak oil production of the United States was in 1971. It started going down from there. And so the embargo was used as an excuse in a way, or maybe as a distraction, but there actually, U.S. had peak oil then.
That was a definitely a pivotal event in U.S. economic history. But then also what we had in the late 1970s and especially in the 80s was the beginning of globalization with the advent of container shipping and computer monitoring of inventory, satellite communications. Suddenly, American workers were competing against workers in Mexico and China. So that provided downward pressure on wages of U.S. workers. And in fact, hourly wages of American workers haven't increased since the 1970s. So what that did was then create the incentive for increasing debt. Up until about 1980, debt and GDP were growing at about the same rate in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
But after 1980, debt started increasing faster than GDP. People still wanted to buy more stuff because they were being advertised at all the time. The desire for bigger houses and bigger cars was being stoked in them. But they didn't have more money, so how are they going to buy all this stuff? By going in further into debt. And the banks helped them do it with all kinds of, subprime mortgages and home equity lines of credit and credit card offers and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
So as,
and this is based on a debt, somebody else's debt being a bank's asset.
That's right. Right.
And the more people, more debt vehicles they have, the more debt agreements and contracts they can get a hold of, the more assets they got a hold of.
Precisely. And so this inflates the size of the financial industry in relation to the rest of the economy.
Yeah.
As all of these assets start to be leveraged through securitization and derivatives,
right,
the power of the financial industry grows and grows, and this becomes also political power as the financial industry begins to contribute to the campaigns of politicians. So they're not contributing to the campaigns of politicians just for the sake of doing so. They're doing it so that the rules of the financial industry can be rewritten. So during the 1990s and the early 2000s, you see the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was the firewall that was put up in the 1930s.
Yeah, that prohibited banks from, banks had to be banks for putting your savings in.
That's right.
Or making a loan to you. They weren't supposed to be an investment brokerage house.
Exactly.
But that took the wall away.
That's right.
Yeah.
And other regulations were taken away or rewritten, which fed the fire even further so that the banking financial industry would grow even further and faster. So we get then to the point of 2008 when we have the biggest credit bubble in the history of the world has been inflated by that point, and it starts to unwind.
And what it has in it, it actually is a bubble that's full of suds. And every teeny weeny little bubble inside has a little piece of property where the value is no longer what it was.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, like you said, leveraged. And the value has deflated. And, nobody wants to, none of the banks, none of the bankers want to deal with or even look at how much bad debt is in there.
Right.
And so that's where we start having huge bailouts.
So at this strange moment in time, 2008 to the present, these last 3 years, we've had the intersection of limits to debt, which we've just been talking about, limits to energy because of the soaring oil prices and the end of cheap, easy oil, increasing competition around the globe for coal as an energy source. And so the two Ds, debt and depletion, have been compounded by a third D, which is disaster. We're also seeing increasing rates of environmental disasters and industrial accidents. And the costs of things like the Deepwater Horizon. The floods, fires, earthquake and tsunami in Japan, droughts, and so on, the cost of these events is skyrocketing. So insurance companies no longer know how to value risk.
That's
right. And that's also putting an enormous drag on global economic growth. So we have the convergence of these three factors in real time that suddenly mean economies just can't grow the way they used to. And so governments have responded to the situation with this extreme measures trying to keep the banking industry from imploding. So the governments have become borrowers and spenders of last resort.
Yeah. In other words, if the economy isn't stimulating spending and borrowing and adequate wages and jobs, then the government steps in with all kinds of stimulus plans.
Exactly. But the idea was this was going to be a short-term problem.
Right.
The government would step in.
I thought it was going to work.
Well, yeah, it would bail out the banks and put in a few $100 billion for shovel-ready projects, and that would get us flipped over back into the growth mode, and everything would be fine. We'd be able to pay off that debt, and we'd be rocking. But what's happened instead is we bought ourselves with these trillions of dollars of stimulus packages and bailouts. We bought ourselves a very short and tepid recovery.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the European economies are teetering on the verge. And economists are calling this a growth crisis.
Yeah.
They're saying, the problem is the economies just aren't growing like they're supposed to. If they did, we'd be able to pay back all this debt. Everything would be fine. But it's just not happening. So what are we going to do? And the solution that's being put forward by a lot of economists is austerity. We cut back on government spending. And it's because the levels of debt that are being racked up by governments are just unsupportable. So we got to cut back on spending. And what is that doing? Well, it's actually making economies contract even further and faster.
Right.
We're seeing that happen in Spain. We're seeing it happen in Ireland. And
mm-hmm.
we're going to see it happen here in the United States because just about everybody is singing from that same song sheet right now.
Yes, we certainly are hearing that, and we're going to be going. I'm going to take a little music break and put on a couple of public service announcements and a little holiday jingle, and then we'll be back. And we're going to concentrate on the whole idea of limits to growth and about the about what is peak oil a little bit more.
Sure. We'll
talk about energy alternatives and just that whole view of things. Welcome, everybody. This is Shift Shapers. I'm your host, Daniel Kerbine, and I have here in the studio Richard Heinberg, who is an author and an educator, and one of the books, his most recent book, is titled The End of Growth. And we're talking about the economy here. The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. And we're going to be talking about what is the new economic reality. But during the last half hour, we've talked about the situation of world debt, the United States debt, household debt, how that all kind of got out of hand, and how governments are really now just, they're kind of at the end of what they really have in the way of assets to hold off and be the lender and the job creator. So there's another factor in all of this, which we're about to talk about, which is where are the resources to be able to have a growth recovery. There have been other kinds of books devoted to the limits of growth, and people have said that's discredited. We're going to always have growth in the economy. So, and also people have been saying that we've been running out of oil for decades. So how does the current situation tie in with all that?
Yeah, well, first of all, the limits to growth discussion goes back to the early 1970s. In 1972, a book was published called Limits to Growth. It was the best-selling environmental book of all time. And it was an effort to use computers to model the interaction between population growth, resource depletion, and environmental impacts. And in the standard run scenario, when they fed all this data into their computer and processed it, the standard run scenario showed peak and decline in world industrial output sometime in the first couple of decades of the 21st century.
Hmm.
Economists looked at that and they said, "Whoa, hang on, this couldn't happen. Economic growth is central to our whole ideology. We have to have constant economic growth." So they tried to pick apart some flaws in the limits to growth study. And they succeeded in discrediting it in the eyes of the public. But in fact, scientists have revisited the end of growth study many, many times, including the scientists who were involved in the original computer modeling simulations. And even with new data, even by doubling Earth's resources and the input data, even by using the computer simulation to simulate government policies to reduce population growth and to reduce pollution and so on. Even doing all of those things, it's only possible to push the world economic collapse, if you will, out by a couple of decades beyond what it was in the standard run scenario.
Mm.
So this is a very robust study, actually. And I think what we're seeing right now is that limits to growth scenario playing out in real time.
Wow. Wow. Like we've reached it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not as though we weren't warned. We had the information for several decades, for four decades to be precise. And yet here we are right now seeing exactly the scenario that was forecast back in 1972 playing out in front of our eyes.
Mm. Now, very interesting, because I remember Ronald Reagan and what a contrast he was from Jimmy Carter. Like, oh, we've got all of it here. It's morning in America.
That's right.
There is plenty of everything for everyone, especially in Texas. but and California. I got to say, I'm still flabbergasted by what you're saying here, because people have always been saying, no, we're going to find more resources.
Sure.
And in fact, I remember even on this movie called The Secret, where this guy was saying, oh yeah, we're so brilliant, and we're brilliant, and we're geniuses, and we're going to find, wherever there's a resource that gets depleted, we'll find new resources.
That's right.
This
is central to economic theory, the idea of substitution. You know,
yeah.
If one resource gets scarce, the market will solve that. It will get more expensive, and it'll make a substitute resource cheaper.
Yeah, right. So, I mean,
by comparison, at least,
like magic crystals or something. Okay, so what about alternative energy sources?
Sure.
I mean, is that going to take up the slack?
Only alternative energy sources, it's also alternative minerals and metals, because oil isn't the only thing that we're depleting. We're depleting, you know, copper and iron ore and indium and gallium and platinum group metals and rare earths. And, there's a long list of minerals and metals that are getting more scarce and expensive too. So how are we doing with substitution? Well, you know, theoretically there are substitutes for most of these things, but in many cases substitutes are inferior. You know, in the 19th century we were using whale oil as a fuel for illumination, and whale oil was getting expensive because we were killing all the whales. So we started using rock oil, which is petroleum, as a substitute, and petroleum proved to be superior from an economic point of view. It was cheaper, it was more energy dense, and the result was, you know, cars, planes, trains, and automobiles,
That's right. So, 150 years.
But now, you know, we look at the substitutes that we have, for oil and other fossil fuels, and they're viable. I mean, we're talking, of course, about electric cars and batteries and solar energy and wind energy. They're viable, and we certainly need to be developing them as fast as we possibly can, because renewable energy is our future. But they don't have the same kind of economic payoff as fossil fuels did back in the early days, back in the late 19th century and early 20th century, because they have much bigger upfront costs. They're variable in output. You know, it costs. Once you have the solar panel up and running, you get virtually free energy. But it costs you a lot to buy the solar panel and install it, and that's a big problem in a world that's facing problems with credit and investment capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, only people who have the credit are going to be able to do that.
And then once you have the solar panel up, well, the sun isn't always shining, and it doesn't shine as long in the winter as it does in the summer. So how do you compensate for that? Well, you have to compensate by rebuilding the entire electricity grid, or by installing, you know, some sophisticated way of storing energy. And all of that is expensive, too, and it's more upfront investment required. So at the end of the day, you know, you have a substitute that may be viable, but you know, it's not going to give you the same kind of economic growth in the same way as fossil fuels did.
Yeah, there's an author named James Howard Kunstler who points out in his book The Long Emergency that it takes oil to manufacture the things you need for solar collectors.
Right, right.
Sooner or later, you have to deal with the resources that are involved that are needed.
I mean, so, in theory, it's probably possible to build a solar factory that would produce solar panels with solar electricity. But not very many people do that just because, you know, it would add to the upfront investment capital requirements.
Mm.
It would be harder. It would be more expensive. So, you know, we use the fossil fuels instead. And we acknowledge that in terms of climate negotiations. You know, we say,
yeah,
well, the poorer countries shouldn't have to abide by the same kinds of restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions as the wealthy countries, because you know they haven't been responsible historically for the emissions,
right.
And they deserve a little more economic growth because people in those countries are already poor.
Right.
Okay. Well, what we're really saying is, if you're burning more fossil fuels, you're going to have more economic growth. I mean, that's what
that is really what
to.
That says, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. Yeah, that's code for let them burn more fossil
exactly.
fuels because
yeah.
they need it. Yeah, we got to figure out our own way out of this. Yes, the wised up must fend for themselves.
Right. So if in fact fossil fuels are getting more expensive, which I think is pretty clear at this point, then that means you know economic growth as we've known it is kind of a thing of the past. So
mm-hmm.
we should be planning accordingly. This may not necessarily be the end of the world. You know, we. Economic growth, as we've had it over the past few decades, has been an anomaly.
Yeah.
You know, if you look back for centuries and thousands of years, yeah, there was economic growth, but it was at the pace, an averaged pace of something like 0.01.
Right.
0.001% per year or something like that. Over the past few decades, we've gotten used to economic growth of 2 to 3 to 5% per year. Yeah, China's economy is growing at 10% per year.
Yeah. And
but that can't go on forever. You know, we have a finite planet. You know, something that's growing at 10% per year is doubling every 7 years.
Man.
Think about that. If China's economy continues growing at this rate, that means 7 years from now, China's economy is going to be twice as big. 14 years from now, four times as big.
Yeah.
21 years from now, eight times as big. Hey, come on. It's not going to
yeah.
happen. You know, there's not enough coal. There's not enough iron ore. There's not enough, cement. In the world
right.
to enable China's economy to do that. So the question is, how big is it going to get, and where do we want it to level off, and how big an economy can the Earth support?
Yes, how big of an economy can the Earth support? Well, okay, so that starts to come to some questions about what is, if we're looking at the end of growth.
Right.
That doesn't mean the end of the world. It sounds like you're
yeah.
not really saying that's the end of the world, but it does mean
it's
some adjustments to make.
Yeah. What we're doing is we're getting back to normal.
Yeah.
A normal economy is what we had before we had the fast-paced, growth-based fossil fuel economy.
Yeah.
So getting back to normal means, you know, things are going to change. We've gotten used to a type of economy that was unsustainable.
Yes.
And so getting back to normal is going to be a tough adjustment for a lot of people.
Hmm.
It's going to be a really tough adjustment for Wall Street and for a lot of governments.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the difficulty of that adjustment playing out in the headlines of the newspapers. But you know, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. So we should be planning for it rather than promising, you know, that with austerity or stimulus or whatever, we're going to get back to the grand old days of 1960s easy motoring. That's a fiction. Instead of that, we should be discussing and planning how we're going to adapt to the end of growth, and how that's going to happen in a way that's acceptable and equitable for the most people. And I think that's really what the Occupy discussion is about too.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see if I can put my brain around this, because it's almost like the climate change thing, because it's like getting when are governments going to start saying, hey, you know what, we've really got to put some brakes on some of this. We got to really put the brakes on our carbon emissions. And in what you're suggesting is, and that what the data that you're bringing forth in the book, The End of Growth. By the way, I'm talking with, you're listening to Shift Shapers, and I'm host Daniel Kerbein. We are talking with Richard Heinberg, author of The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. So I'm having trouble picturing politicians in an election year saying,
yeah,
hey, folks, I've got a fantastic platform.
We're going to shrink the economy.
That's right. We're going to shrink the economy, and we're going to – I represent the end of growth.
Yeah.
I vote for me.
Yeah, ain't going to happen. Yeah. No, I mean, it's perfectly understandable why politicians are lying to us about this.
Yeah.
The question is, do they, you know, behind closed doors, do they understand what's going on, and do they have a plan B? And unfortunately, I don't see any evidence that they do.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is they're listening to their economists, their economic advisors, and the economists have been schooled. They have gone through university and they've gotten PhDs, and a requirement for getting the PhD is accepting the ideology of continuous, unending economic growth. So they don't believe that the end of growth is even possible.
You know, there's something else in all of this too, because I mean, when we start talking about that we've reached peak, well, like you said, peak everything. That's
right.
One of your books.
Right.
Really, folks, you got to check out Richard Heinberg's book list. It's amazing. It's not just the book list that he might recommend that you read. It's the list of books that he's written. Okay. One of them, there's The End of Growth that we're talking about right now. End of the Party's Over, which is about the end of oil. And there's a number of other ones. Okay, so here's where I'm going.
Yeah.
We've got the end of growth with the economy, but then we also have the realities of dealing with, okay, resources getting harder to come by.
Right.
And all of the things that we count on, like transport, things that we count on having to do with how are we going to be able to manufacture the shoes and the clothing and
right.
and things of that nature. I mean, it seems as though if things were meticulously managed to where, you know, priorities were set. I don't know. What do you think? What are your thoughts on
this? What we would do in that case is we would make more stuff locally. Because what we've done over the past 3 or 4 decades is we've globalized production and consumption. And we did that because we could, because we had the cheap energy. And as I was saying earlier in our discussion, you know, we did that because labor was cheaper on the other side of the planet. And so that meant bigger profits for the manufacturers. It also meant cheaper manufactured products for American consumers who didn't have much money because their wages were increasing.
Because the wages were going down. So it was a strategy to keep growth going.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But now that oil is getting more expensive, now that transport fuel is more costly, that means that we're going to have to basically turn that trend on its head and relocalize economic activity. That doesn't mean that trade is going away. It doesn't mean that shipping is going to end overnight. What we're talking about is the reversal of a long-term trend. And if we plan for that, I think it could be good for Main Street, you know, because one of the big problems, of course, of the last 30, 40 years is that we've lost so much manufacturing and therefore manufacturing jobs.
Yeah, what we've come to is we're Walmartized. We've got and Walmart has its factories in China, so you got this huge transport of materials from China to Walmart. Without the massive oil use, you wouldn't have the goods that are at Walmart. And then, you know, you've got so many other businesses, local businesses, that have been driven out of business by the Walmarts. That's an example of an industry, so to speak, or a retail model that's entirely based on unlimited oil as a resource.
That's right. We've hollowed out the economy, and we've replaced the real economy with a fake economy based on Wall Street excess, and it's killing us. It's killing what's left of our economy, and it's killing killing us as human beings. Our psychological well-being has actually declined as a result of increasing dependence on consumer products to satisfy ourselves, as a result of having to work longer hours just to make ends meet as a result of having more members of the family having to go out and get jobs in order to pay the rent and mortgage. So we're actually worse off as people.
Yeah.
As we've been pursuing economic growth over these past 30, 40 years.
Okay, so localizing. Yeah, that would be that. You know, that would really be an amazing initiative to have at the government level is a localizing.
Absolutely.
Now, and it looks like it's just starting actually on the local level independently.
Absolutely.
And people
yeah.
starting to get together and say, look, we cannot count on the government to do anything for us.
Well, right here in Santa
Let's
Rosa.
Let's go local now.
We have the Go Local program here
yeah.
in Santa Rosa. We have the Share Exchange on 5th Street in downtown Santa Rosa. These are examples of things that are popping up in towns around the country, and it's a result of people who understand these trends. They may not get the whole entire big picture that we've been talking about with oil depletion and limits to debt and so on, but the general trend of events, I think, is becoming clearer to more and more people. Our food system is going to have to be relocalized. There's a huge local food system movement all across the country. People like Michael Pollan have been,
yeah.
you know, writing and speaking eloquently about this for years, and it's really gaining traction. And it's not just a matter of a boutique, you know, local food tastes better and so on. That's true. You
right.
know, it's not just a Martha Stewart phenomenon. We're talking about survival
We're
here.
Talking about the Safeway truck ain't showing up no more.
Exactly. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not forecasting that that's what's
no.
going to happen
and
tomorrow.
Nothing at Safeway.
And, you know, as a result, you should, you know, get a gun and ammunition and and stack your pantry with canned goods. Although, you know, I think there are things that we should be doing as families and as households to prepare
yeah.
for financial instability.
And that could include occasional interruptions.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, but what you're talking about is like, well, you know, where we first met and just, then this was where we first met was at an event that was hosted by Transition Albany. Mm-hmm. And the Transition Town Movement is all about that having that and creating that kind of self-sufficiency in communities
That's right.
where they're actually growing their own food, and they've got some amazing programs there.
Right. The Transition Movement is this grassroots effort in towns and cities across the world, really, to do what our elected leaders can't do, which is to rebuild our society and our infrastructure from the ground up on the basis of what's local and what's sustainable. You know, if our elected leaders can't do these things, then what are we going to do? Are we just going to give up and go sadly into the into
right.
the mist? No, I mean, we're going to do what we can as households and communities. And a lot of the stuff that needs to be done actually is best done at that local level anyway, because
right.
that's the direction we're going, as we've been talking about, toward a more localized economy. So why not get the ball rolling
right,
right where we are, with local currencies, with local food systems, with car share and ride share networks, with local banks and credit unions instead of the big banks. I mean, this is one of the things that the Occupy movement
Very interesting.
Has also addressed.
Yeah.
You know, and the big banks are dead men walking, really.
And they're up until even before
they got
zombies.
Us into this huge mess, so why should we be rewarding them with our checking accounts and our bank deposits? We should be putting our money in the local community where it's going to do the most good. And local credit unions and some local banks invest most of, or in some cases virtually all of their depositors' money in the local community. So that's, you know,
Very
that's where we're going to live. These are the people who we're going to be. Our neighbors are the people who we're going to be depending on as time goes on increasingly. You know, when we had a growth-based economy, it was all about more money, work harder for more money. So,
right.
And so we were hiring people to do stuff for us that we used to do for ourselves, or that our family members or friends or neighbors used to do for us, whether it was child care or, you know, this or that. Well, as the economy transitions, as the economy as we've known it starts to come apart at the seams and is replaced by a different kind of economy, you know, we're going to have to do more for ourselves and more for each other. It's going to be more of a gift economy, less of an exchange economy, and that means we're going to have to be nice to each other.
A kinder, gentler economy, more difficult and requiring more generosity and ingenuity.
Yeah, but as a result, you know, if we have to be nice to each other, that mean, and we all are in the same boat, that means it's going to be more fun to be alive because we're going to
be interesting,
we're going to be with people who are looking out for each other.
That seems to be something that's been missing from the culture these days.
That's right.
Is being happy about things. I'll be getting back to this interview. You're listening to Shift Shapers on KBBF FM 89.1. We're talking about The End of Growth with author Richard Heinberg and his book, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. We'll be right back, and we're going to be, I want to talk a little bit about local currencies or whatever other kind of ideas you might have.
Sounds good.
And we're going to get back to the program. I'm your host, Daniel Kerbein, and I have Richard Heinberg in the studio here with me. So, yes, so we're talking about being local, like part of this, some solutions that we might find toward, this kind of like imploding of the international global debt economy.
Yep.
To have it become more like localized currencies and economies. What's your take on like local currencies? Is that something that actually can be done?
Yeah, definitely can be done. There are hundreds of local currencies in use throughout the country and throughout the world. And in times of economic turmoil, having a local currency can be like an insurance policy. This happened back in the 1930s. You know, when a lot of places in U.S. and Europe were seeing really, really dire economic straits. People just didn't have money. You know, there were still factories, there were still people who wanted to work, but there just wasn't the money to make it go. So where people had local currencies, it was like they had a way to keep the exchange process happening. Now, local currencies are hard to get going,
mm-hmm.
and under normal economic conditions, typically, they're just kind of a little add-on feature. You know, you can't usually pay your rent or your mortgage or your taxes with local currencies. So,
right.
You know, people use them for getting their lawn mowed or massage or exchanging garden veggies or something like that. But it's not a mainstay of the economy. But if the official currency becomes dysfunctional, then local currencies can step
they have a reach. They have a chance of thriving, actually.
Yeah.
That is one of the things that I looked into it because there are a number of little local currencies that have been starting up. In fact, there's been an ongoing project to get a local currency called the out in the Sonoma Valley, and it has a Jack London theme to it,
mm-hmm.
and I think they're called Sonoma Jacks.
Oh,
is the name of it.
Hadn't heard of that one.
They're like $1, $10, and $20 bills, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's Berkshire's in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and they've been successful for a while.
Right. And the Ithaca Hours in Ithaca, New York, which is a time share kind of thing.
You can actually get some of the currency by trading some of your time with the time bank.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach, too. And one of the things that I found in my research is that you can have a local currency. You can print money. It is legal to print money in the United States, but you can't call it legal tender.
You can't call it U.S. dollars.
Right. You can't call it U.S. dollars. You cannot call it legal tender. Like if you have to settle something in a court, like you go to small claims, if someone takes a small claims and you have to pay, $800 or whatever, it can't be in Sonoma Jacks.
It's got to be in federal currency.
It has to be in
right.
U.S. currency, right.
Federal Reserve currencies these days. Yeah,
that's correct.
Right.
Or that's what's backing your check when you write it. So, but other than that, it's perfectly legal to print money.
Yeah.
As we know in our discussion here, it has to be something that people are interested in using because you can have a bunch of pieces of paper and
and the pieces of paper really are secondary. Money is based on trust, really.
Yeah.
So if we have a functioning local currency, that's really like a functioning local trust network, and it can be a way of increasing the whole local economy. You know, all of that money is going to stay within the local economy. Whereas if you're using federal dollars, much or most of that money is being drained off by the national banks and by big corporations, and very little of it ends up staying in the local economy.
Very interesting. Just by the fact of using dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Well, these are some of the things that you can find out in the book, The End of Growth. First of all, it's a fantastic, really basic analysis of how economies work. If you ever want to have a basic understanding of economics without having to read many, many books, there's about 3 chapters here. That's all you need to read to get the basics of how the U.S. economy works, and really, to a degree, how the world economy works. There's a lot in there.
I have to say I had a lot of help with that. You know,
yeah.
I interviewed about 2 or 3 dozen people for this book, including former managing director of J.P. Morgan, former hedge fund managers, former vice president of Lehman Brothers, economists, ecological economists, as well as conventional economists, and this was over a period of many months, and I got kind of a basic education. I'm not an economist by training myself, I'm just a writer, but I felt really privileged to have had these conversations with these people and to have gotten an overview of economic issues from kind of a high level, and so that's really where the book comes from.
Well, if you would have gotten an A on your midterm with this, but only chapters 1 through 3, because then you start to violate and question the basics of economic growth, and that's where if it's probably a teacher somewhere other than New College, they probably say, you got to prove. Wait a minute.
You can't say that.
Wait a minute. What do you mean? No. And actually, that is the point of the book. It starts to bring in factors that you really aren't hearing. You're certainly not hearing in the media all that much, and you're certainly not hearing them from your standard traditional classic or neoclassic economics, which says growth, 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 growth. It's there. It's inevitable. It's always there. Always will be there. All we have to do is kind of dig our way out of this little pit that we're in, and we're going to just be soaring again. Well, this little book calls to question that premise, because it brings in the one factor that's been taken out of classic economics that needs to be put back in, which is resources.
Yeah, standard economic theory says basically the earth is just a pile of resources that we use to make products, but they ultimately become waste. So
a lot of waste.
The environment is basically a subset of the economy in classical economics,
yeah.
Whereas in reality, the entire human economy is a subset of the environment. We are denizens of planet Earth, and if Earth is not doing well, then our economy is not doing well. And it's a tough lesson, but we're learning it. I think very unfortunately too slowly, but it's becoming more and more obvious.
Yeah, we're definitely starting to see it. And the hopeful part of all this, and I hope that everybody who's been listening throughout this last half hour has captured it, which is the hopeful part of it is that we have a shot at localizing our economy. In fact, we really have the work in front of us. It isn't just that we have a chance to do it.
Yeah.
We have the work in front of us of developing local economies, doing our shopping locally, looking at places where local production of food can be happening. Looking at it from the shift shaper's point of view is that we need to get going on this right away. We need to be making sure that when the collapse comes that we've got something in place. That's basically the position of shift shapers. But even if you don't look at it from that point of view, if you just want to look at it from the point of view of, man, we got to do something about downsizing this global economy, it still comes down to locally producing the food and the trade and the things that we need every day. So that is an opportunity for real community, real happiness, really getting away from the stranglehold that we've had of debt. So, Richard Heinberg, anything that you'd like to say to conclude our interview?
Sure. Your local farmer is your friend. And find out who is growing food in your local community and support them, you know, whether it's a CSA, community-supported agriculture, or a store that features local food, like Community Market. Those are the people that we should be supporting with our dollars.
And we thank you very much for coming onto Shift Shapers on KBBF FM 89.1 to talk about a fantastic book, The End of Growth. So we've had here Richard Heinberg, author of The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. And we are about to put in a little music break.
And it's time for me to go home and put my chickens to bed.
And it'll be, yes, yes. In fact, I'm going to replay something that I had on in the first hour. It's just, hey, what can I say? I just like the beat of the whole thing.
Fireman's strike. Watch out.